Thank you very much. Good afternoon. According to Thomas Carlyle, history is a great dust heap. Well, if that's true, then that was then, this is now, is a gigantic metaphorical hoover running over the pile of smut, metaphorically sucking off all the interesting historical personages. Then we metaphorically take that dust, metaphorically extract the DNA, and metaphorically recreate their lives and experiences right here in the studio. It's a bit like Jurassic Park, but more dust-based and with no dinosaurs. But we leave all the boring historical characters on the dust heap where they belong, including dull old twazzock Thomas Carlyle. He's as crap and uninteresting as the town he gave his name to. If anyone from Carlisle is listening is offended by that statement, then please turn off your radio. In fact, if you're listening in Carlisle and weren't offended by that statement, please turn off your radio as well. We're not so desperate for listeners that we require your custom. Everyone hates you, you Carlilian idiots. Anyway, here at the show that everyone's calling Twitutin. Not you, Carlisle. I told you, turn off. We want to blow the dust from history, and we don't need a metaphorical hoover set in reverse to do it for us, because we have a cool and sassy house band. These guys really blow. In fact, that's how they got this particular gig. It's Christian Riley and the Pretenders to the Throne of King Henry the VII.
That was then, this is now. Richard Herring's last gig there was poorly attended.
That is reason enough. Stupid Cumbrians. Never cross me, never, or you will pay.
What, by not being allowed to listen to this show? Ooh, harsh punishment.
Hey, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.
Me and the guys, we played Carlisle earlier this year and the theatre was packed. It was one of the best and most switched-on audiences we've ever had.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway, Christian, we've been getting a lot of fan mail and comments from the desperately sad individuals who frequent comedy internet forums. And you and the band are one of the most popular things on the show.
One of the most popular things.
The only popular thing on the show thus far. But I don't understand it. What have you got that I haven't got?
What you mean, apart from good looks, talent, comic timing, raw sexuality, friends, deodorant... The ability to say no when offered a pie.
I have that ability. I just modestly choose not to demonstrate it in public.
Or private.
In Tony Blair's Britain, you never know when you're under surveillance, Christian. My modesty is everything to me. I will not have it compromised. But apart from good looks, talent, comic timing, a raw sexuality, friends, deodorant, and the immodesty to say no when offered a pie, what have you and the boys in the band got that I haven't got?
Musical instruments.
I've got a euphonium.
And the ability to play them.
Why are the public so demanding? Why? Let's see if they'll be satiated with two or three, depending on the edit, quick one-liners about what happened in history this week.
October 1911, Roald Amundsen sets off on race to South Pole. He wins, and his opponent Scott dies in a tent on the frozen ice plains of Antarctica. If Paul Radcliffe's listening, that's the acceptable way to lose a race.
October 17, 1662, Charles II sells Dunkirk to France for £40,000.
And if you just sign here and here...
Oh, there is the money.
Thank you very much. Ha-ha! You suckers! Dunkirk is already a part of France! Ha-ha! You idiots! Shaw! No refunds! You bought Dunkirk when you already owned it, you French nincompoop! Hooray! I'm running away with the money now! Bye! Well, have those two or three jokes, depending on the edit, satisfied you?
No!
What do you want from me? Blood? My gametes? As usual, I've been too lazy to do any research this week, so will you please welcome my History Corner regulars, my old history teacher from school, Mr. Morgan, and Shepherd's Bush pub quiz champion, Brian O'Green.
Thank you, Richard.
Hello.
If you don't mind, Richard, I'd just like to defend Carlisle against your defamatory statements. It is a very interesting town. Not only does it have Hadrian's Wall to the north, but it has also been the administrative centre of Cumbria since 1974.
Yeah, shut up, Brian.
Yes, and actually, can I add that me and my estranged wife, Hillary... Oh, hello, Hillary, if you're listening. Can you please just let me back in to pick up my stereo? Then I promise I'll leave you alone. I really will. I just want the stereo. And another chance.
Mr. Morgan!
Sorry.
This is not the time. Stop.
Sorry. Anyway... In happier times, we once went on a caravanning holiday in Carlisle, and we found it a charming place, and the people were lovely. You know, the local service station has a mock-up of Hadrian's Wall in the children's play area.
Do you have any children, Mr. Morgan?
No, Hillary isn't able to have kids. It's her tubes. It's probably something she won't want me talking about on national radio.
So, Mr. Morgan, you've been flicking through my tomes. What historical stories of import have you uncovered?
Well, 20th of October, 1632, saw the birth of Sir Christopher Wren, hailed as a national hero for rebuilding London after the Great Fire of 1666 at the behest of Charles II.
I think there's more to this Great Fire than meets the eye. Let's find out if I'm right in a section of the show I like to call What Really Happened.
That was then, this is now. What really happened?
These designs for the rebuilding of London are quite magnificent, Mr. Wren. I must compliment you on the haste in which you have put them together.
Why, thank you, Your Majesty.
I believe there are some parts of the city that are still smouldering, and yet you've already put together a series of complicated technical drawings demonstrating how best they can be restructured.
Yeah, well, I work fast.
It's almost as if you somehow knew there was going to be a fire.
What absurd nonsense.
These plans seem to be covered in a fine white powder. Is this flour?
I often eat bread when working.
They smell a bit of paraffin.
Yes, I was refilling my lamp.
What's this written on the back?
Oh, just some working out.
It says Pudding Lane, underlined with a question mark. That's where the Great Fire started, isn't it? Mm. In a bakery.
Yeah, what are you suggesting?
Observers on Parliament Hill said that the fire took the exact shape of your laughing face.
A mere coincidence. Do you know how long it would take to lay out combustible material to achieve such a fire? 2 days, 21 hours and 13 minutes. You can prove nothing.
Well, what about this then? It's a to-do list called Christopher Wren's to-do list. One, buy matches. Two, burn London. Three, rebuild London, make loads of money and become famous. That's underlined three times.
All right, so you can prove something.
This cannot go unpunished, Sir Christopher.
Oh, I beg you, Your Majesty, don't expose me. I'll do anything. I'll build a monument to your beloved Nell Gwynn that will dominate the London skyline for all time.
Tell me more. And that's how St. Paul's Cathedral got its distinctive bosom-shaped dome. Don't write in to complain to me about that word bosom. It's an historical fact. That's what really happened.
That was then, this is now. History's clock is forever pressing against us.
Well, the big story of the week, Richard, has to be the Battle of Trafalgar, which took place 199 years ago on the 21st of October. The English won, but Admiral Lord Nelson was shot and died on the quarterdeck of HMS Victory.
I think that was fate punishing Nelson for his hubris. It was slightly presumptuous of him, don't you think, to name his ship Victory in advance when he hadn't actually won anything? I mean, he got lucky, the ship did have a victory, but personally I'd preferred a less cocky name.
The HMS Fingers Crossed.
Yeah. The HMS may the best ship win.
The HMS, it's the taking part that counts.
Yeah, it's more English, though, to be like that. But, you know, you have to give it to Nelson. He did really well for a man born with one eye, one arm, and that 100-foot column growing out of his feet.
Sorry, is it a column?
Oh, yeah, Nelson's column isn't just a statue. It is an exact, anatomically correct recreation of his strange and freakish body. If he'd had a bony face, he could have been Pope, but unfortunately... He just had that column, but he overcame his disability to rise up through the Navy, starting as a mast slash lookout combo before becoming an admiral. Amazing story, inspirational. And then I feel sorry if it wasn't bad enough for his mum calling him Horatio. The poor lad was terribly teased at school. The other lads used to write bawdy limericks on his column when he wasn't looking. You can imagine.
Yes, yes. There was a young lad called Horatio whose legs and body were well out of ratio. The girls looked at the volume of his stupendous column and said, however, will we give you...
Mr. Morgan, please.
I was going to say the time of day.
No, you were not. You're in enough trouble with the school already without that kind of behaviour going on. Now it's time for Carlisle's most popular music combo. It's over to Christian Riley and the Pretenders to the throne of King Henry VII.
On the 21st of October, 1918, a lady in New York called Margaret Owen set the typing speed record. 170 words per minute. A week later, she failed a drugs test and was stripped of her title. She was off her head on tea and bourbon biscuits. But seriously, this is her fictitious story.
Good people, please pay some heed to where your life is going. God-fearing folks, listen close as I sing the ballad of Miss Margaret Owen. She was just a lowly secretary with an average typing speed. Faster typists would put her in her place. She said, I'm tired of getting sand kicked in my face. I'm gonna be the fastest typist in the land and get me a big pay raise. She took her typewriter to the crossroads. She cried out, I wanna type like the devil's own. I wanna be the richest secretary in the land. Devil take my soul and guide my arthritic hands. Well, the lightning cracked and the thunder rolled. And a figure with horns and a tail was summoned. Miss Margaret laughed and she said, hello. Devil, I did not expect you to be a woman. The demon said, child, you're mistaken. I am not Satan. The devil's just a bit too busy tonight. So sit right there in that orthopedic chair and let the devil's secretary show you how to type. So they typed and they typed till the morning light. And Miss Margaret clocked back in at nine. Her entry was piled high that day, but it was empty by 9:05. The top pimple chief, he looked on in disbelief. He said, Miss Margaret, you are the best. Yeah, you are born to type, you got a real appetite. And then he put another 1,800 files on her desk. It was then she realized there was no ladder to climb, and all of her dreams were lost, and the devil appeared and whispered in her ear, said, don't you know a deal with me is always a double cross? He said, I've come in person today because I need a new PA. I promoted my last one all the way to the top. Margaret said, I'm not surprised. She really could type. And Satan smiled. No, she just slept with the boss.
And now it's that time again for this week's Births, Deaths and Marriages with TV's Emma Kennedy.
It's time to find out who got wed, bred or dead with TV's Emma Kennedy.
Hello, I'm TV's Emma Kennedy. The Daily Mail once called me the most irritating woman on television. Smoking. Anywho, enough of my yakking. And on to matters fetal, fatal, and ultimately futile. Only Josh and you married folks. So who's blowing out their candles this week? The 17th October saw a happy 79th birthday to boxing commentator Harry, you know what I mean, Harry, Carpenter. Now old and frail, his only involvement in the sport of boxing is as a fan and as the probable next opponent of Audley Harrison. But stop smiling and or laughing and arrange your face into the shape of a tiny puppy with a broken paw, because this week is filled with sadness for those who died. The 19th October, 1216 saw the tragic death of King John, killed when he was attacked by biplanes and fell from the Empire State Building. But let's throw off our mourning shrouds and prance with joy abounding, because this week in history saw composer Johann Sebastian Bach marry his niece, Maria Bach. Kinky. But I'm sure they had a successful wedding night, seeing as Bach was famous for his passions and his hair on a G-string.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Emma. I can't really let that go.
Oh, what now?
How would being famous for his hair on a G-string make for a successful wedding night?
Well, you know, G-string, like the G-string, the underpant.
All right, well, even assuming it was that kind of G-string, which it clearly wasn't. Well, all women wore bloomers in those days. How would being famous for his hair on a G-string make for a successful wedding night? It doesn't mean anything.
Well, it does, because he was also famous for his passions.
Johann Sebastian Bach was famous for his key structure and tonal allegory. Everyone knows that. Not for lewd or suggestive behaviour. His passions were not, as you seem to be suggesting, a reference to his libido.
Yeah, but it would be funny if they were.
It would not be funny. They refer to the passions of Christ, an intensely serious and spiritual time for any practising Christian person such as myself. Not subject for lewd mockery. Our Lord Jesus Christ was not a sex object.
He was for Mary Magdalene.
This isn't the Da Vinci Code now, Kennedy. Get back to TV where you belong. Learn your craft there before you dare to come on the radio again, you mawkish binge.
Stop calling me mawkish!
You are mawkish. You express emotion in an awkward or foolish manner.
You just read that in a dictionary.
And your jokes are rubbish.
Then why do you keep having me on, if only to send me away in shame?
I don't know. It makes no real sense. See you next week.
That was then, this is now. Annoying the people on the BBC Radio 2 forum. You think that the station should be music-based. And uninterrupted by puerile comedy, then ironically mocking them in song.
Wasn't.
Now it's time for the very popular and now undeniably regular slot that I like to call Conspiracy Theory Corner.
I've told you before, Brian, it's not a regular slot, and I am now, even as we speak, distancing myself from it.
OK, here goes, conspiracy fans. 18th October, 1939. Lee Harvey Oswald is born. 20th of October, 1973. The Queen opens Sydney Opera House. 23rd October, 1958. Boris Pasternak wins the Nobel Prize for Dr. Zhivago. All these things happening in one week in history. Coincidence?
Yes.
No. Coincidence is not a word in my vocabulary.
You just used it.
Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill JFK. The truth is far more sinister. As we all know, Oswald famously said, I am a pasty.
Patsy? He said, I am a patsy.
No, no, Richard. That is what the American government wants you to think to conceal the truth. Oswald was a complicated cyborg life form made entirely from meat, potato and pastry. He was literally a pasty built by a shadowy cartel made up of the CIA, the Mafia and Ginsters.
Well, I don't know why I'm bothering to ask, but where does the Queen opening the Sydney Opera House come into all this?
Well, Richard, what does the Sydney Opera House look like?
An interesting if ugly 1970s designed public building?
No, it looks like a gigantic Cornish pasty. Think about it, the ridged roof.
So, Brian, let me get this straight. You're claiming there is some sort of international pasty-based conspiracy featuring the Queen and Lee Harvey Oswald.
I think you hear me knocking. I think I'm coming in.
And Boris Pasternak?
Boris Pasternak?
Yes.
Can't you see, Richard? They're all in on it. JFK was going to outlaw the importing of Cornish pasties, and they silenced him. Mm. If you take all the words from Dr. Zhivago and rearrange them and add a few more, it's clearly a confession from the Queen that she killed JFK using a high-velocity trained corgi.
And what about the small fact that Dr. Zhivago was published before President Kennedy was killed?
Hmm, sinister, isn't it?
Brian, thanks very much for that. It was really good.
That was then, this is now.
sitting atop the dust heap of history and being disappointed with the view.
On 17th of October 1938, famous motorcycle daredevil Evel Knievel was born. But that day also saw the birth of our final guest, Evil's somewhat less notorious twin brother. Please welcome Good Knievel.
Hello, Richard. Thanks for having me along.
It's nice to meet you. So your brother's called Evil, yeah. And you're called Good. Yeah. Your parents clearly had a sense of humour.
No, Richard, this is deadly serious. As I'm sure you know, in every pair of twins, there is a good and an evil twin. It's yin and yang, preserving the cosmic balance of the universe.
But in every set of twins,
yes.
Who's the evil twin out of Matt and Luke Goss?
Matt is the evil one. Everyone knows that.
Really? What about the Alessi twins from Neighbours?
The one with the slightly wonky mouth was the evil one.
Yeah, I thought so. So, who's the evil one out of you, Good Knievel, and Evil Knievel?
Well, Evil is the evil one. I, Good, am the Good Knievel twin, obviously.
I was just checking. A truly evil twin might call himself Good to throw people off the scent.
Yeah. True, but would a good twin call himself evil? You haven't thought this through.
Yeah. You're good.
I know, that's my point.
So, are you sure about this, Good? It's just that Evil Knievel has never struck me as a particularly evil character. All I've ever really seen him do is jump over lots of double-decker buses on a motorbike, usually crashing, which is a bit stupid and rubbish, but evil...
How could you say he is not evil? Evil travels the world with his Evil Knievel show, encouraging people to do wheelies and jump over ramps and such like. Do you know how many children were injured last year in Britain alone, attempting to emulate him on their push bicycles?
Was it none?
Last year, none, yes. But in 1975, almost seven children fell off their chopper bikes, one of whom had to seek medical treatment for a twisted ankle.
Oh, dear. Was he all right?
In the end, yeah, it was fine.
Thank God. So, what do you, Good, do to counteract him?
Well, I tour the world with my Good Knievel show, in which I give displays of how a motorcycle should be ridden properly, pointing out safety codes and general road awareness.
Not quite as exciting a show, I imagine, as Evil Knievel jumping through burning hoops and stuff.
Well, perhaps it is not as popular in box office terms, although I had a fantastically well-attended gig in a place called Carlisle last week. Do you know it? It's a beautiful place.
Shut up about Carlisle, it's not.
But, Richard, why don't you wait until you see the show? I'll do a bit of it for you now.
Good.
Yes?
No, I wasn't saying your name. I was saying it was good.
Oh, sorry. That happens quite a lot.
I can imagine.
So here it goes. The Good Knievel Show. Please welcome me, Good Knievel. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Good Knievel Show. Now, before we start, it's very important that we check our basic kit is up to scratch. The helmet, or tin, should be full-faced, right, to provide protection for the nose and jaw, not open-faced, as worn by my reckless evil brother, Evil. Now, he also has promotional stickers on his helmet. You should never do this, as the adhesives break down the silicon, thus weakening the helmets. Now, if you drop your helmet, even once... on the floor, that's it. That's useless.
Good.
Oh, you like it?
No, I wasn't praising you. I was trying to interrupt you with your name.
Oh, I see. That happens a lot.
Apparently. Are we going to get on to some actual motorbike riding?
Well, not until we're correctly kitted up, Richard. Now, it's clothing. Whatever you wear, it must be warm. Coldness kills. Personally, I use these handle mittens attached to the front handles of the bike, which, when you put your hands inside...
No, sorry, no, this is rubbish. I never thought I'd say it, but, for the first time in my life, I wish I was watching Evel Knievel.
No, don't say that.
What? I want Evel Knievel.
No, if you say his name once more, you'll summon him from hell.
Good. Because, I'm in hell at the moment. I want to see Evel Knievel.
Done. It's Evel Knievel, and I'm too young to die.
It's a 66-year-old man on a motorbike. Ooh, scary.
Do not mock me, Harry. Good Knievel, I have come from the bowels of hell to settle this once and for all. I am fed up with your motorcycle safety, and now I will destroy you.
Oh, how reckless. He's not even using his indicators.
Silence! This battle will determine once and for all whether good or evil will rule the world.
Very well. I am ready.
Bring it on!
Oh, this is amazing. We are about to witness the ultimate showdown between good and evil, as predicted a bit roughly in the Book of Revelations. This surely has to be amongst the most exciting things ever to be broadcast on Radio 2. Unfortunately, our 27 minutes is up, and there will be hell to pay if Clive Anderson's chat room did not go out on time. So I'm afraid we've got to go. But we'll be sure to let you know who won on next week's show. Personally, I'm hoping it'll be evil. That's always been a favourite of mine. That was then. This is now. Good or evil, we don't know yet. Afternoon!
Mirror signal manoeuvre!
That was then. This is now. Is written by and starred Richard Herring, Emma Kennedy, Danny Robbins, Dan Tetzel, Christian Riley, and the pretenders to the throne of King Henry VII, who were Lambert Simnel, Perkin Warbeck, Damien Caldwell, Charlie Round Turner, and Martin Kane. With additional material by Mark Dady, Toby Davis, Chris Pell, Richard Ward, Colin Birch, and Nice Mum. The broadcast assistant was Trudy Stevens, and the producer was Liz Anstey. That was then. This is now. Is a Celador production for BBC Radio 2.